Thank you. It's tough when you look like this and you get up and they start to laugh. It's rough. I want to say something before I start speaking, and that's a big thank you to you, Californians, for being so kind to bring a frozen Canadian whose money you don't even accept. God knows what's happened to the Canadian peso. You know what I'm talking about? It's rough. But it has been a marvelous conference, hasn't it? I'm actually supposed to be female and quite English. You know. Didn't you love her hair? It was just... Yes, Sister Teresa and I. And... You should have spent some time one-to-one with her. What an incredibly powerful woman, and just an incredibly powerful representative of this thing called love. It's neat. Anyway, my name's Marty J., and I am an alcoholic. And if you're new in the room, that probably sounds pretty juvenile, you know. I'm Marty, alcoholic. And, hi, Marty. It sounds so dumb when you're new. It really does. I remember thinking, oh, my God. I mean, this is worse than Kinsman. But we say that for a reason. I mean, it's a really good reason. We want you to know a lot about us right away, very quickly. Because otherwise, we've got to go through the whole deal. I'm Marty. I'm not what I actually appear to be. I'm completely selfish and self-centered in the extreme, and sometimes I step on the toes of my fellows, and they retaliate seemingly without provocation, but invariably I find that I've actually set the thing in motion, and then it emotes deep feelings of resentment inside of me, and then I'm cut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and when I'm cut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, I find that the insanity returns, and when the insanity returns, I drink, and if I drink, I die, even though at times I used to drink and relieve these feelings at the end that no longer work, but I found that once I started to drink, I could not control the amount I drank. In fact, I could not quit drinking once I started drinking, and through some incredible miracle, I stumbled into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and today I live one day at a time with a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, and oh my God, that's a lot to say. And so we just say, I'm Marty, I'm an alcoholic, and when you say, hi, Marty, then I know you know that I know that you know, and it's just okay. So I don't know how they figured that out, but it's pretty bright, isn't it? And you can get off airplanes anywhere in the world and say, hi, I'm Marty, I'm an alcoholic, and they'll say, you're not Marty. No, they'll say, welcome. They'll say, welcome. We're so glad you're... I've done that in the Netherlands. I've talked in Belgium. I've been blessed in this fellowship to travel around and walk and talk with drunks all over this world. And you know what the big news is? We are so similar, it's terrifying. That's why I know it's a disease. It is consistent in its symptoms. It is incredibly monotonous in its development. So I don't know about you. I've got people in my home group, by the way, that have feelings disease. I don't have that. My feelings work really good. You know, I haven't got damaged feelings. When I'm feeling guilty, it's usually because I'm guilty. That's in my experience. If I'm really afraid, and every feeling that I emote seems to be based in one of two areas, either fear or love. In Ray's case, it's heat, but nevertheless, it's fear or love. That was cheap. That was cheap and unnecessary. And Ray, I apologize. I don't want to get that thing Frank got going and apologize 25 times in one talk, but. Anyway, these guys have damaged feelings, and I always kind of think it's like this. It's like you're going down the freeway in California, you're going 120 miles an hour, the cops pull you off, take you to jail, charge you with speeding, probably negligence, and you say to yourself, you know, I got to get that speedometer fixed, because that's really the root of my trouble. It said I was going 120. But it's just deep down underlying the cause of why you were in such a hurry. There is the problem for me. There's another group of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that run around and they're talking about having their capillaries adjusted or something. Every once in a while you'll read in the Los Angeles Times or some other newspaper that a doctor has invented a way for alcoholics to drink normally. And I always think, he's an alcoholic doctor. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the reporter was a drunk, too, because he's a... I hope this works. Oh, God, I hope he's... You can't adjust our capillaries to make us drink normally because I don't want to drink normally. I want to have the effect of alcohol. It says Dr. Silkworth, 1935, said that we drink largely for the feeling. So if they screw up my capillaries, I don't want that stuff anymore. And then there's another guy running around, and I kind of think he might be right. He talks about it being a disease of perception. That probably fits a lot better for me. The way I see things is just amazingly different than the way the earth people see things. I mean, God help us doing a report alongside of somebody who is not one of us, because they don't see the color in everything. They don't seem to see the moves underneath and behind and around and the real sinister part of what's going on. People don't pull out on the freeway and get in front of you because they need to get somewhere. They're doing it to bug you. It's with malice of forethought. I know that. Every alcoholic knows that. But earth people just go, oh, geez. You know, I saw a bumper sticker in Los Angeles last time I was there, by the way. It said, cover me, I'm going to change lanes. Anyway, I think I do have diseased perception, because the way I see things has always been quite different, and I've heard countless, infinitely more articulate speakers than myself trying to describe the gap that is in people like us. This distortion of the way things actually happen. But some of my earliest remembrances, age 8 or 9, I had this sense of being apart from and surrounded by blackness and madness, absolutely convinced I was adopted. My parents wished. My poor mother, you know, I had no alcoholism in our home, and when I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, my poor mother, she said, oh, God, what will you do next to disgrace this family? It was like, it was the end of the road for her. I'm happy to report that before my mother slid into Alzheimer's disease, she became one of the biggest fans of Alcoholics Anonymous in the entire world. I remember her saying, if ever you needed a family, you certainly have one now. We just didn't seem to be able to give it to you. Anyway, 8 or 9 years old, I remember standing in my bedroom thinking about suicide, thinking, God, they are going to be sorry when I do this. I like people to suffer on my behalf. It's what I used to think was the definition of a relationship, for heaven's sakes. It's like mutual suffering. You know, it was some people call it a hostage-taking, bondage, whatever you want to call it. Relationship with an alcoholic is an exciting, sometimes terminal event in a person's life. I was in my room, and I'm thinking, I'm going to jump off the roof of the house and smack down onto the patio, and then they will be sorry. And suddenly in my little alcoholic brain, I realize I'm going to be dead. I won't be able to see them sorry. And I averted my suicide. Many of us don't. There are undoubtedly people in this audience who are saying to themselves, Marty, that is not funny. They've lost somebody to suicide. I myself have lost a couple or three people to suicide. I don't make light of the disease of alcoholism. This thing is a terminal, progressive, ugly disease. But we have learned, as it says in the big book, that we are like people who have been rescued from a sinking ship, and we're in the rescue boats, and there is camaraderie and fellowship from the captain's table to the steerage, and we are people who do not normally mix. When I got to AA, I thought that meant we drank everything straight. That was the only thing in the big book. I said, yeah, okay, I've got that. Sicker than most. So we make light sometimes of things that don't seem very funny to people who are involved, but if we didn't, I swear to God, we'd die. We either laugh or we drink. And so you're... You understand this, don't you? Good, that's good. There's always one go-getter in every class, you know, it's like... Should have heard you guys last night. You should have heard the belly laughter coming out of you last night with that Bob Bizance. You should have heard the joy of God just sweeping through this audience. It was incredible. One time in Montreal at the World Convention, I said that I'd gone from a drunk to a monk because I got real spiritual in the early part of my recovery. In fact, I got so earthly, heavenly-minded, I was of absolutely no earthly good. I could heal the holes in records just picking them up. I mean, I'm not talking spiritual. I'm talking spiritual. You know what I'm saying? And many years later, I was I was at a convention and I was speaking and a man came up and he said, "Are you Marty J?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Are you the guy who went from a drunk to a monk?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I'm a monk. I went from a monk to a drunk." I said, "Okay." And he said, "I had been in monasteries for 27 years on my knees on the hard pavement, depriving myself in search of God. It was not until I heard the laughter on that tape that I heard the voice of God." And he said, "It was so clear to me that this is a loving father who loves his kids to be happy." And so he came out of that monastery into Alcoholics Anonymous. He's confused as the rest of you are now. I'm happy to report that. And living a full and happy life. And it's just an amazing thing how one alcoholic sharing his experience, strength, and hope, or her experience, strength, and hope with another can cut through layers upon layers of prejudice. Because if there's anything we have when we get here, that's what we got. I don't mean racial prejudice. I mean believing, prejudging that we know when we don't know. In fact, if you read the early chapters, more about alcoholism and so on, it talks constantly about you will not get this if you don't lay aside your prejudice. And so Bob alluded to it last night. I'll say it today. In the business world, they call them paradigms. This is the big buzzword of the 90s. Paradigms. It means little rules that you've made up for yourself, things that you understand. That's how things go, right? And if you think about, any of you play golf? Is the Pope Catholic? Excuse me. Anyway, think about teeing off from a golf course and you're just 15 degrees off in your swing. Well, when you start, it doesn't matter because the ball doesn't go very far. But the farther you hit that ball, the more serious that 15 degrees becomes. And so if your thinking is 15 degrees off, you're probably Al-Anon. No. Joking. Okay, it was just you went quiet on me. That's all. I was just. Now, if it's 75 degrees off, you're alcoholic. But anyway, just think if your thinking was off 15 degrees, and your understanding of how things actually went as your life went and things sped up and more people came into your life, would there not be more havoc wreaked through your life as you try to exercise these paradigms? Do you know what they call paradigms in Alcoholics Anonymous? 1935. They call them old ideas. And it says some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas. And the result was? Yeah, nil. Till you let go, absolutely. And so all I can tell you is that we're not asking you to do anything remarkable in Alcoholics Anonymous. We just want you to change your entire life and how you think. Simple, but not easy. So we have to say, easy does it, and some of these little slogans, one day at a time, because if you faced a paradigm shift in your life of this magnitude all in one day, you'd be drunk. That's why, you know, the nuke, and I'll tell you something else that I really understand. Alcoholism progresses inside of me whether I drink or I don't drink. I didn't get alcoholism drinking. I am alcoholic, therefore I drink alcohol in an alcoholic way. That's really important to understand because I continue to deteriorate even though I don't drink. I'll prove that to you. Take somebody like this man, which Uncle Bobby was talking about, I think, 42 years sober, went out and got drunk. Now, how long did he last? Not very long, because the alcoholism had continued to progress. Now, here's something that is really devastating. If you're around 6, 7, 8 years sober, I don't want to scare you, but if I don't, I'll be disappointed. You see, it says in our book, and it's very clear, that if you want to recover, and by the way, the only assumption in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you want to quit drinking. That's interesting. We have people who just can't get it. Well, they don't want to quit drinking. That's a prerequisite to sobriety. Just thought I'd share that with some of you. That it's tricky, but it's in there. So, if you want to quit drinking, and the book says, we assume you want to quit drinking, then you have to adopt a spiritual way of life. It says that that is the only solution, is a spiritual way of life. But what it reveals from there is most instructive. It says that those that recover on a non-spiritual basis have not lost complete control of their drinking yet. So that some of us may come in here and only be marginally addicted to this thing called alcohol. We might only have a marginal drinking problem, and we just quit, and for a period of time we don't need God. We don't need the spiritual part of the program. We're just cruising, and everything's okay. And then one day, as Bob said last night, your rear end falls off. What's happened? Your alcoholism has now progressed to a place where nothing but a spiritual solution will do, and you haven't learned a spiritual solution. And so you get what God lovingly calls a slap up alongside of your head. And I see people bumping across the AA landscape, you know.
It's good. It's good, you know.
And, well, I'm not drinking. No, but you're bleeding from every orifice in your body. You know, like, let go. Let go of the rock. When you first come into AA, it's like God issues these big kites, and you just, up you go, right? And you're just sailing. It's the pink cloud thing, and you're looking down at those old-timers and thinking, oh, man, if they knew how to do some of this stuff that I'm doing, stupid old farts, you know. And, I mean, after a while, you kind of get bored with just being above the crowd, and you decide to do a few acrobatic stunts, you know. Maybe a little affair on the side or just something. And what happens is that you lose altitude immediately. You just whack and you get stuck in the rocks and you're just hanging there. And those guys are above you now. And those pukey newcomers are way up above you. And you're just stuck in the rock. And then one day, one of those old farts with the hook on the bottom of the kite comes through and they pull you up. And you kind of gain some altitude, and then they let you go again, and you just boom, 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 boom along the AA landscape until such a time as you say, ah, screw it, I can't figure this out. Up you go. See, this is a really interesting story. Yeah. It made a lot of sense in the psych ward I spoke in last week. Sorry. Should never try and transfer the experience, but... So I want you to know, if you're here today, and I know some of you are hurting, and I don't want to make light of that, and I don't know where you're from, I don't know what your pain is. I know that the wall that's in front of you looks like you can't climb it. I know some of you have had some terrific beatings out there in reality, but the fact of the matter is that the power that is now inside of us is infinitely more powerful than anything that's against us. And if you can just let go to that thing, you will have an amazing change in your life, as I have, and as almost 2 million other people have had in their life. The proof of that is the fact you're in this room this morning, listening to a mentally damaged Canadian. You know? Yeah. Praying for me, some of you, I'm sure. Saying, that boy's going to get it. About 3-4 more years, and he's going to be okay. When I was 11 years old, my perception was that everyone is against me, that no matter what I do, it will turn bad. I am bad. I'm a bad person that occasionally does good things. I am not a good person. I am a bad boy. And I was in my aunt's, Auntie Bailey. Auntie Bailey was 200 years old and had blue hair. And she taught my mother in school, and she was still teaching school. She was so old that I just couldn't believe she could still walk, and she was my teacher. So, I mean, I was disrespectful, and my perception of things was that everybody over 50 should be put to sleep. Now, I'm getting touchy about that now. Then, it made a lot of sense, you know. But Auntie Bailey sent a form around, and it was like one of those little religious forms. You know, what's your church background, so on, and I could not remember for the life of me whether we were Protestants or prostitutes. I knew we weren't Catholics, but I could not remember, and I wasn't trying to be smart. I honestly could not remember which one of those words was the right word, and so I took a guess. So anyway, I'm out in the hallway, and I got pain. Because I've been humiliated. Now, my perception was that this was the end of the world. Every grade 6 class in the world would now be sent a memo on how stupid I was. See, one of the perception distortions, if you're alcoholic, like I'm alcoholic, is that what you do is really important. I said to my sponsor one day, oh, when I walk in those rooms, they all stare at me. He said, Marty, when you walk in the room, you'll never know how little they care. Like, you have no idea. In fact, they're all wondering if you're watching them. So, relax. Now, that might have been a big deflation for you. It was one of the most wonderful pieces of information I ever got, just how unimportant I was in the main scheme of things. Anyway, I'm in this hallway, and I'm developing these feelings of what I later came to understand was resentment. A resentment is nothing more than a reoccurring feeling, a reoccurring thing that you can't deal with it. It just, like, it comes up in your face and you go through the whole episode again. And then you retaliate. I'll tell you, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, between the retaliating over the resentments and the sexual fantasies, I was tired out. I was just exhausted. That very night, I'm over at a little buddy's place and we're in the bathroom, like little buddies do, and he had a gallon of Loganberry wine. Heated Loganberry wine. This stuff is great. It's purple when it goes down, but when it comes up, pink. Pink, foamy, floats on water. Special. That night, I had the thing happen that makes me an alcoholic. Now listen carefully. If you're new in the room today and you've got the, I don't know if I am or I don't know if I'm not, listen to this. Normal people get depressed. Normal people contemplate suicide. Normal people have fears. Normal people feel insecure and different than and apart from. But normal people cannot change their perception by taking a drink. And we can. It's magic. You actually owe your lives, many of you, to alcohol. If you want to know the horrible truth, if you did not have, if you would not have found that elixir at some point in your terrible unreality, you probably would have done yourself. But because of alcohol, we were given a reprieve long enough to discover this miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous, and some people who actually do understand. And so that night in that bathroom, I drank this stuff, and I had the instant qualifications to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because immediately upon my friend spitting that beautiful stuff into the toilet because it tasted bad, I knew with a certainty he and I would not be associating anymore. I changed companionship. I blacked out. I got on my bicycle. I had an understanding about speed I had never quite grasped before. I knew I was faster than any other human being on earth. The only problem was there was a truck parked in about 6.5 blocks from where this rocket ride started, and I hit it. I know, whack, into the truck, and I caromed across the pavement, and as I'm hitting the pavement, I can remember this vividly, thinking, it doesn't even hurt. This. Yes, Jesus, it doesn't hurt. The knees are out of my pants. I've got pink foam all over me. I go to the back door, and Her Royal Majesty, my English mother, opens the door and goes, ha. And I start to lie. You know, oh, I only had two. Two drinks and I'm this sick, Mom. I'll never touch this stuff again. In the meantime, in my head, I'm thinking, I learned how to laugh in French. Oh, man. My dad beat me up. I couldn't have cared less. It was not an issue. And then in a bathtub, and I had the, you know. In the morning, I get to school, and I tell the other kids in grade 6, you'll never guess what happened to me last night. I got into this wine. I puked. I hit a truck. I got beat up. You guys got to try this stuff. Well, isn't that special? You know. But I lost contact with my grade 6 class. It was amazing that from the time of that first drink until grade 12, I became almost like an antibody inside that class, just a seething cauldron of resentment and activity, and never participated, never considered those kids ever again to be my peer. My peer were much more desirable sort of nighttime characters, thieves, and bullies, and people that drank to excess, and I liked them. It was just electric. You were always right on the edge of doing something that was just going to make the news. You know, it was. I played in rock and roll bands from the time I was 13 till the time I guess I was about 20 when I finally stopped that. I had hair. I know, you believed the story up until now, didn't you? It's sort of like going okay. And I never expected to live this long. I never expected anywhere beyond 24, 25 years old. It just didn't make any sense to me to go beyond that because you get wrinkled up and saggy, and I just thought, well, you know, live fast, die young, be a good-looking corpse. And That was the center of my world, and yet at this other side of me, and the piece that I want to say to you today, if you're new in the room, if you've got a spiritual hound chasing your rear end all the time, which I had, just this spiritual hound always chasing me, Marty, come home, sort of, you know the story of the prodigal, this kid that went and took his inheritance and slept with the pigs. This is an interesting story, by the way. This kid was Jewish and he's raising pigs. You can hear his daddy's doing what? Oi! But anyway, He's raising pigs. He squanders all his inheritance. He's sleeping around. He turns into a complete pig. He comes home because he figures maybe I can work as a servant on my dad's land because I'm hungry. I'm eating the husks for the pigs. That's how bad it's going for me. And when he comes home, his father is on the veranda watching him go up and down the road trying to make this decision. That's how I see my father, my higher power, God, watching me sometimes going up and down the road saying, come home. Come home. It's okay. And this kid got, by the way, got his inheritance back. Got his ring back, got his land back. And the interesting part of that story is that his brother was really upset about that. He didn't think his dad should take him back. And I don't know about you, but when I got sober and I started to get successful in my family, they didn't like it. They didn't like it. It was like, oh, comes Mr. Moneybags is home. You know. So what's going wonderful for you this week, Marty? You know. Not everybody's going to be glad you're sober and well. I, by the way, never have yet had any of my intimate friends, the you know, around the kitchen table, 6 o'clock in the morning, friends. Not one of them phoned to find out where I was when I left the beer parlor. Pub. No, what do you call it? Bar. Sorry. Canada, they're called beer parlors. Sort of like ice cream parlors, except you fall down after you've had it. So, my high school was, it was a disaster. I felt so stupid in high school. And then I get these really high marks, and then I thought I fluked it, and oh, you know. Just nothing at the center, and the big book just nails it on the head. It said I wanted people to think a certain way about me, and I presented this thing to the world, and I knew deep down inside I didn't deserve anything that they were saying about me. Oh man, that's awful. And when I drank, I turned into something else, something bigger than life and wonderful. And why would, you know, if you're an Al-Anon in this room and you're judging us for our alcoholism, please think about it. If you could drink something and turn into Superman, would you drink it? And if it did it many, many times in a row, would you continue? And then when it stopped doing it, would you just try and do it every once in a while just in case it's going to happen? Like, say, the last 20 years of your drinking. I left high school in grade 11. I got into the radio and television business because I'd heard that that was the highest divorce and alcoholism rate of any industry in Canada. And that's where I wanted to be, was with the movers and shakers, and I got in there. My boss was a drunk, and he fired me for drinking. I don't understand some of the things that go on. He didn't really fire me. He said, your last few days here have been your last few days here. So what would you like to do, Marty? Resign or be fired? You pick. So I resigned because that was humiliating. I had started to be required to pay some of the tickets of alcoholism, and the heavy drinker knows what I'm talking about. I mean, in the early days, you roll the car and everybody walks away. And you get in a fight and the next day you drink coffee together. And it's not a big deal. Everything's just kind of like, you should see what happened to you last night. And it was great. And then you start paying tickets. And the first major ticket I paid was with a friend named Clint Melville. And Clint, we were drinking vodka one night and he said, I bought this gun. I bought it in Mexico. I'm going to blow my head off with it. And I said, well, let's get her done. And he shot his head off. You know, the reality of that was just incredible. It was like somebody dropped a piano on me or something. It was like, my God, this can really, I mean, this isn't playtime anymore. This stuff's starting to happen. Then I had friends killed. I had another friend shot, and I had another one knifed, and it just, all drinking-related things. And I found that the people I was drinking with were getting weirder and weirder. And the reason, of course, is because the earth people that drank with you can't stand the pace or the aggravated assault. They hate that when you stand up and slap them across the face when you're drinking for no apparent reason other than the fact that, you know, they needed it. I knew they needed it. I expected them to say, thanks for that. Some of them retaliated seemingly without provocation. And my life became, here's a phrase that you can take to the bank, unmanageable. I began to do things I didn't want to do. And I was completely incapable of doing the things I did want to do. That's how simple unmanageability really is. And so after I got laid off the radio station, I spent, I'm going to say 2 months, maybe more, I don't remember, in a bedroom drinking Scotch whiskey with my mother, feeding me this stuff, because in her opinion, I had had a nervous breakdown. And so she thought that, you know, it was medicinal. Me and the bunny rabbits and the alligators in my room thought it was special. You know, it was, I couldn't go to the house. I was so paranoid and afraid. And we're talking here about a kid that's maybe 17, 18 years old. So I really have a lot of trouble when young kids come into Alcoholics Anonymous and people say to them, aren't you lucky to be here? And you know, when I was a young guy and I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and people say that to me, I would think to myself, how could you possibly be an alcoholic and have stayed out there so long? You must have been faking, because I couldn't have stayed out 1 week longer. I today have a damaged liver. I drank all I could handle by the age of 23. I got here at precisely the right moment. There is no such thing as, oh, you're so young, you're lucky to be here. We're all lucky to be here. And I'll tell you, I just watch a brick go in the wall between an old timer and a young person when they say that. It's like all of a sudden maybe you don't understand, you know. So I went home, I eventually got off alcohol for a period of time, and I want to explain something to you newcomers in the room. Alcoholism, without any question in my mind, goes into things called remissions. For periods of time, I would drink quite normally. And then, just like it stopped, it would start again, and it was with no stimuli whatsoever. I would just go off, and I would be just insane again. Well, through the most part of grade 12, I was in one of these remissions, and life was good. My marks were at the top of the class. The teachers had all come around. They were taking me in the lounge, staff lounge, to smoke. I was meeting them in the pub at night, you know, the teachers, because I was kind of a kid that was older because I'd been away from home. Life was good. And then about, I don't know, 2 months before the end of the term, I went down one night, and it happened again. That thing happened again, the blackouts, the insane drinking, the not showing up, the doing, saying, and being things that I couldn't believe. Do you know what really aced it for me with the drinking? I could no longer even guarantee to myself what I was going to do. That is the most terrifying statement in the world. I could not say to you with certainty that I would not murder you tonight. I could not say that. I had no earthly idea if I would or I wouldn't. I got through school. I went to university. Took Alcoholism 103. I understand you can actually take courses at university, too. I mean, I was out of the nest, man. I just went mental as soon as I got away from there. I just drank around the clock, day and night, as much as I could possibly get. Got back into the radio television business, and that's how alcoholism, it gobbles up your life. And so by age 21 or 22, I'd met this absolutely incredible human being named Shirley, and she is a beautiful Norwegian, blonde, gorgeous woman that I just about drove insane. We're still married today. I probably love Shirley more today, standing at this podium, than I ever did when she was 18 or 19. We've been together since we were 17 years old. But I didn't know her at all. And that's something that I just, you know, I thank you for, because I couldn't get from here to there. See, I had this British mother that used to run my father around. And I used to watch that. My perception was, and again, this is a diseased perception, wasn't really what's going on. My perception was, if a woman has an opinion, she will run your life. Therefore, just do everything you can to destroy her credibility so that she never has an opinion. I'm not proud of this. I'm just reporting to you how sick it was. And her illness was that I destroyed her to the place where she was afraid to leave me, because she honestly believed, based on the information I'd given her, nobody else would want her. The fact that every time I get drunk, all my friends would hit on her amazed her. Yeah. Enraged me. But the fact of the matter was, she, deep down inside, she was a hole as well. Big spiritual hole. Now, we get pregnant. I have no memory of this transaction. There was... it didn't start out pretty. I had a suit on, and I had an accident. And taking the suit off in the shower, and I can kind of remember that. And then the next thing I know... Anyway, she's having a baby. Now, this is what you really need when you're alcoholic and you're going to commit suicide, because that's all I was thinking about at this point in my life, was suicide. I was 21 years old. I had been the radio... television manager of a TV station in British Columbia. I was like a shooting star that went up and went like that. I had been through about 14 jobs in the next year, none of which that I could keep. I was a disaster in every area, and people would say to me, you are so bright. And as soon as they said that to me, I intuitively knew they were stupid. No one would say that to you in their right minds, would they? And so I lost respect for me and for them, and this spiritual hole got bigger and bigger, and I just raced around trying to fill it with something. Anything. and I was just desperate. I came back to this little radio station I worked at on the prairies in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And they hired me for half the money that I was making when I left. That's how bad it was. And I thought, I'll just work here quietly and die, and nobody will ever hear of me again. 21 years old, done. And for a period of time, I went into a remission, and it happened again. And they promoted me, and all of this stuff started to happen. And hey, one day I went across the street for a beer with the boys, and a bus went by my face. And on the side of this bus there was a bus board, and there was a little boy in bed holding a baseball glove, crying. And it said, "A few drinks after work with the boys, what does it cost?" And I looked at that and I thought, what kind of a jerk would leave a little boy in a bed like that, missing his baseball game? Me. I had a little boy in bed. I had everything that picture depicted. But I was in denial. I have a disease called alcoholism in which the perception is not to do with me. I go to meetings and I hear people talking about their problems and I feel sorry for them. When I should be saying, that's me. That's exactly my behavior right now. I need to do something about that. And I'm sitting there thinking, that poor guy. Man, if I could pray or do something for him, I'd be happy to do it. You know, I'm sure that if you could hear God out loud at some of our meetings, he would be saying, oh, man, how long do I have to persist with you idiots? It's just like, oh, man. We got a little house. I was coming home, and then this thing happened again. And I just want to finish up this drinking thing. I had sworn on a sacred oath that I would never drink again. Now, I know that nobody's ever gone to that extent in California, but in Canada, a lot of the alcoholics do that. It's sort of like the Canadian national anthem. If you can get me out of this one, God, I will never drink again. So I had done that prayer, and I went to work, and when I got there, the president of the company called me into the office and said that they were not going to fire me, that they thought I was just maybe a little artistic and overwhelmed, and I needed to find some other sort of ways to vent my energy other than shoving a pizza in his face at the staff party. The station girl on whom I was hitting decided not to press charges. It was a good day. And, oh, man, what a mess. I'd smashed my 1959 Thunderbird up. Oh, God, I love that car. I hit the bridge 3 times on the way over, but I did not spill my drink. 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock. I'm in the record library. The storm has kind of blown over, as it does with alcoholics. It's amazing, isn't it? What happens when you're alcoholic and what you actually get away from. Normal people spit on the sidewalk and they're in jail for 3 years. That doesn't happen to us. We seem to just dodge the bullet and dodge the bullet. And so I'm in the library at 5 o'clock and I'm thinking, did I tell God I'd never drink again? Or did I say to God, I'll never drink again to excess? And then I remember the Bible. This is alcoholic rationalization. I'm thinking, before Christ even started his ministry, he was in Cana. And his mother said, make some wine. And he performed a miracle. Do you remember this? Turned water into wine. And the host said it was such good wine, it was better than the original wine they served. I thought, Jesus Christ wants us to drink. There's no question. He would not have done that as his original miracle if he would not have wanted us to drink. Well, you know, I didn't want to go against God. So I decided to go over and have a couple of hoots. I don't know whether you know this or not, but when an alcoholic takes a drink, there is a couple of things that happen. It's described on page 21 and then again on page 24 in the big book. It's there twice in case a dummy like me misses it the first time. It says that for people like me, that once I start to drink, I cannot control the amount I drink. And it says before I start to drink that I have a mental blank spot in which I cannot remember the humiliation of a week or a month before. I'm completely defenseless against the first drink. And I'm here to report to you that day as I crossed that street and I saw that bus board and I went there for a beer, I was in a strange mental blank spot. I honestly believed that I was going for a drink. 4 o'clock in the morning, I am being pulled out of an apartment by a rather large man. I remember the Pointer Sisters singing Steamed Heat. I remember Because I went in and out of blackouts. Like, my God is not the merciful God you have. My God used to wake me up just as I was puking in the fishbowl, or just as my fly was open, or just as I was falling down the stairs. I'd come out of the blackout. Oh, thank you, God. You know, you couldn't keep me asleep for the bad part. Some woman would say that I was with her. I couldn't remember that, but down the stairs, remember that. That's the kind of God I got. Hey, wake up, stupid. Look what you're about to do. I remember my wife and my child being there. I don't know how they got there. I remember the car. I remember spinning the car out of control. I remember thinking about Clint and his head. And I remember thinking, I'm going to die an alcoholic. I remember thinking, I am hopeless. This is the end of my life. And now I'm going to kill my wife and child. And then it was morning. I can't explain that to you. I don't know how we got home. I don't know how that car didn't kill us all. All I know is that in the morning I had a nauseating reality coming in on me, bits and pieces of the evening coming back and thinking, oh, God, I really am in trouble. And the phone was ringing way off in the distance. And I walked over to the phone and I picked it up, and it's my stupid sister. And she's got the question du jour, you know. She says, how are you? Whoa. How does she think up these questions? You know, I said, well, other than the fact that I'm going to puke in about 5 seconds, I'm fine. How are you, Laurie? And she said, you know, Marty, I just want to ask you a quick question. Do you think you have a drinking problem? I'm thinking, I drink more than anybody else I know. I drink longer than anybody else I know. I definitely have no problem drinking. None. And I know that that sounds like I'm not even trying to be funny. I swear to God, that was the sequence. Then she says, would you talk to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm thinking, I'm going to lose my job. My wife is going to divorce me. I don't know what shape the car is in this morning, and now you want me to help somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. How much bloody pressure can one person take, Lori? I knew something hit the floor. It was my watch. I've got to be very careful for time here because I don't want to bore any of you. I agreed to see this person. This individual comes into my life. He's a Norwegian. Now, that might not mean anything to you. My father-in-law was Norwegian, and my father-in-law used to swear at me when I went to pick Shirley up. I'd go past him, and he'd go, Furly, 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 furly. And so I hated Norwegians. And this guy's out of the car 2 minutes. He's a 1976 Ford LTD. He didn't park it. He docked it in front of my house. It's robin egg blue with like an AA banner on the top of it. Practically a light that's, bring out your drunks. Bring out your drunks. You know, I was like, holy God, what have I got myself into? And he's a comedian. This guy's funny. He says, I understand you drink even when you're not thirsty. I got a resentment. Right now, I got a resentment. He takes me to a coffee shop. I had never been in a coffee shop. Two grown men in a coffee shop. It just seems so stupid to me. And then he's telling me these stories. And I'm thinking, when are we going to get to the lecture? You know, like, give me the bloody lecture and let's go home. And he didn't. He never did. He just told me he got drunk and broke a train in half and drove his car across and robbed a liquor board store. And I'm thinking, I've done worse than that. So I told him some of my stuff. And I guess I did about 3/4 of my fifth step, just trying to impress this guy. You know. He says to me at the end of the conversation, no one of us chooses to call another one alcoholic. But let me suggest this to you, Marty. It seems to me that, like, most of the time you're in trouble, you are drinking. Do you not think that if you didn't drink, maybe you'd get in less trouble? I had never, I swear, God is my witness, had never crossed my mind. Because when the pain of sobriety was so great I couldn't stand it anymore, I drank for relief, not for trouble. I couldn't stand it sober. It wasn't the drinking that was causing me the trouble. So this was a paradigm shift. This was an old idea. This was the smashing of a lifelong concept in a second, like that, from another human being who actually knew. Huh? And I thought to myself, I got to get away from him. Now, but he's an alcoholic. He's smarter than I am. He says, I'll pick you up in the morning for a meeting at 10. I leave the house at 9. He's waiting for me. Oh, my God. It's the CIA. Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. This went on. We go to this meeting. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. There was old people there. Old. wrinkled up. People are drinking coffee like that there was going to be a ban on coffee. Within the next week, there'll be no more coffee. Peeing over their own heads, honestly, just copious amounts of this coffee, and they're going up and down some stairs or something, 12 stairs. I couldn't figure it out. One guy was stuck on the fifth stair, and this other really old one that looked like he died at least a week before the last meeting, he yells across to this other one, "You better get off that fifth stair. You're going to get drunk." I'm thinking, where the hell is that fifth stair? Let's go for that, son of a gun. They're talking about, there's not even any relationship between what one's asking and the other's answering. I'd never been at anything like it in my life. I figured it was something to do with Nabob, a coffee promotion or something, because it was just like, and then this really old guy, the leader of the pack, at the front of the room says, "If you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, you're ready to take certain stairs." So I'm looking around and I'm thinking, well, let's see what they got. They're all 100. They're going to die. They're wrinkled up. And they can't drink for the rest of their lives. Oh, I want what they got. Oh, God. I'm thinking, they gave us choices just before that. The choices. Oh, yeah. Join Alcoholics Anonymous, go insane or die. So I'm thinking, I'll take death. Out of those three, give me death. The meeting finally ends. It's been over a month long, at least a month. I'm figuring it's going to come up. There'll be a season change. It was forever. I don't know what they were talking about. And they're laughing at stuff that's not funny. People are peeing their pants, and they're laughing. I'm thinking, that happened to me Thursday. That's not funny. Give me something funny. God, it was a humiliating experience. I'm coming out of the back of the place where the meeting was, and I'm saying to total strangers, I'm not alcoholic. I'm just visiting this meeting. The alcoholic I'm with says, shut up, you're embarrassing me. You know. So we get up. I'm an alcoholic. He says to me, how'd you like the meeting? I said, I loved it. That was a good meeting. In fact, I almost wish I was alcoholic. You guys have got something going there, Duane. I mean it. And if you guys need any free radio time or a donation or any single thing I can do to help, you just call me. He said, oh, I'll call you. It's no problem at all. And he dropped me off. And that was Sunday morning at the breakfast group in Saskatoon. And that night at 8 o'clock, he showed up to pick me up for another meeting. Now, I thought I'd been fairly clear, but So we go to another meeting. Now, this was a different meeting altogether. There were some of the old ones from the first meeting at the second meeting, but this one had some women in it. Hookers, I figured, because this was Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the last house in the block. There's not going to be nice girls at Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when they come to that part, they said, does the newcomer have anything he'd like to ask? I said, yeah, are you guys hookers? And Ruth, God, you know, talk about God speaking. Ruth looked at me, she says, no, I was never a hooker, but I used to pick up anemic little pukes like you every once in a while. And if you were a very good boy, I'd take you home. You know what I'm talking about, big boy? I don't know about you. I didn't like the women in AA when I first got to AA. I got out in the car and I said, Duane, let me make this perfectly clear. I don't want to go to any more meetings. He said, what on earth does that have to do with anything? Of course you don't. You've got a disease. I said, I don't have to go. He said, oh, yeah, you do. Once we get you, we've got you for 90 days. It's the law. That's it. I said, I've got rights. He said, you've got a disease. You have no rights. See? Somebody said, let me tell you what. Let me make you this deal. He says, Marty, if you want a drink, you phone me. I will bring your first drink over, and then I'm going to break every bone in your body. And I said, why do you people have to aggravate one another the way you... Why do you talk like that? And he said, because I know if you drink, you're going to get beat up again, and I don't want you to be hurt by strangers. I'll do it myself. So that's the kind of sponsorship. That's sponsorship. I don't know who your sponsor is. Some wimp that says, well, whatever, feels good, do it. You know, it's like, I'm sorry for you. Get yourself one of those ugly, poopy, tell you the truth, look you in the eye, kick you where it hurts kind of sponsors, and you'll probably get sober. I did. I lived for the 90th day because I knew on day 90 I was going to kill him. And I was going to kill his dog. He had a dog. His dog was so old that it couldn't bark anymore. You'd come to the door. And then it would go. I figured this dog should go to a meeting. It's that old, but God. It was named Tinker. Dog's name is Tinker. He's 6'5", 200 pounds. He's got this dog with asthma called Tinker. And they're saying, I'm insane in step two. I'm saying, please. Anyway, I'm figuring I'm going to kill the dog. I'll set his car on fire. I mean, day 90 is here, and then it happened to me. As it happened to many of you, I had somebody get deep down inside of me spiritually and just wrench the guts right out of me. Spoke to me at a level at which I had never been spoken to. His name was Wesley Parrish. He was from Pomona Beach, Florida. He was about 3'2". He weighed 7,000 pounds and had $10 million. I hated Wesley's guts the minute I saw him. And when he finished talking, everybody was all, oh, you wonderful. I'm thinking, let me out of here. Day 90, baby. Drink and burn. Anyway, I was happy. I head for the parking lot. I don't realize Wesley's left everybody at the front. He's after me. And he says to me, what's wrong with you, boy? And I said, you. That's what's really wrong with me. Little pukes like you coming into our country with all your money. I'm sick of listening to you. And he said, shut up. You know, I'll tell you something about yourself. And he did. And he, for the next 15 or 20 minutes, he told me stuff that I knew Dwayne had told him. And then he started telling me stuff Dwayne didn't know, so I figured Shirley had talked to him. And then, oh my God, he started telling me stuff neither of them knew. Big, big stuff. The piece, the God-shaped hole that I had inside of me, he just put his hand right inside of there. And just for a second, I was all in one place, all at the same time. I had never had that happen except for that first drink in that bathroom. All in one place, all at the same time. I was amazed. I get in the car on the way home, I say to my wife, you know, even though the 90 days is up, I think I'm going to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says, what? I said, I'm going to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you could have left? Dwayne told me you were never leaving. Like that. What a journey. I got to tell you a quick story about someone like me trapped on a desert island for 30 years. And one day, out of the clear blue, a big cruise ship pulls up. And the captain says, we're off course, but we'd be happy to take you with us. And the guy realizes, I'm rescued. And at the same moment, he realizes, oh my God, 30 years I've built on this island and nobody knows anything about any of it. So he says to the captain, can I show you around? Captain says, by all means. So they go to this house this guy's built. It's huge. It's got drapes and curtains and running water. It's a miracle of engineering. And they go down to the other end of the island, and there's a couple of little huts. He says, what are those? And the guy says, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my club room. That's where I go every Wednesday night, and I've never had a newcomer come or anything, but that's where I go and I sit. And the guy said, okay, what's that hut over there? He said, that's the group I used to go to. That has nothing to do with my story, but I don't even know why I had to share that with you, but somebody in here needed it, I guess. Then I went from a drunk to a monk. I just rose a little above Dwayne, and I went back to the church, and I used to sit in a church. I have nothing against churches. In fact, I believe with all my heart and soul in the God of the church, but I sat there, and I was thinking, I wonder if those choir girls wear anything under those gowns. I wasn't thinking healthy, God-like thoughts yet. You know, I was sick. And the pastor came to me one day and said, when you're in a church and I'm up there preaching, who's the audience? I'm thinking, well, the people. And he said, you see, that's what's wrong. See, here's another paradigm shift, another spiritual 15 degrees. He said, when you are in the church and I'm talking, we're all talking to God. He is the audience. Just as it is in this room, Marty's giving a little book report, and you're the kids, and you're, you know, making everything I do bona fide and real, and my higher power is saying, tell them like it is, you little jerk. Try the truth, Marty. Try that. They'll like that too. Go ahead. You know. And so I have this new understanding, this father, this person that's beside me at this podium, this power that's in my life on a daily basis. And he says that his grace is sufficient for someone like me. That he demonstrates his power in my weakness. See, as long as I plug into that thing, I have this I gain this altitude spiritually, and I come to places like this, and I walk among you, and I listen to you, and I talk to you, and I fall in love with you everywhere I go. These rooms are so wonderful. It's the first time I've ever talked in California. You know that? All the times I've been in the United States of America, first time I've ever been in California to talk. Thank you very much for that.
I'll be back.
Maybe not. And so what I really want to leave you with today is that I was hopeless, helpless, surrounded in madness and blackness, and the concepts by which I lived didn't work. And I came to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I listened to your 12 steps, and I thought, like, that's going to work for someone as complex as me. Yeah. I walked by an old-timer one time, and I heard him say to another guy, "Hey, there but for the grace of God goes God." I know, they're not nice in Canada like they are down here, but that's the kind of spiritual beating I needed. I had my sponsor phone me one time and say, "You got to come and hear this guy. He talks on humility. He's going to get you to understand humility." I said, "I don't need to know anything about humility. I know I'm good. That's humble. Just knowing you're good." He said, "No, no, no. You need to hear this guy." We go to the meeting. About 500 people at the meeting. They introduce the speaker. It's me. I go to the microphone and pass. You know, I thank you very much for inviting me, and I just like to listen. We get out in the car and I say, "Oh my God, is that, now I understand what you mean now when Bill Wilson said that some of us gain humility by a series of humiliations." Like, okay, I get it, I'll never speak again. He said, No, that's not the lesson at all. The lesson is that you've gotta understand that you're a servant when you speak. That's the lesson. So what's gonna happen is next weekend you're speaking in a little town called Bazano, Alberta. And don't worry about your talk, I'll help you with your talk. So like for 7 hours in the car, we rehearsed this talk. I got this thing nailed. I'm ready. They call the speaker. It's him. Dr. Silkworth said that some of us require deflation at great depth. And I've had some of the great depth deflators, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I swear to you as I stand witness before you that the toughest things in Alcoholics Anonymous have been the things that have saved my life. I remember that old sponsor sitting out in the car with me one time and saying, "Marty, you're the most chauvinist pig I know. You need to run your marriage by tradition too." And I said, "Oh, what is tradition too, Stan? Share it with me, please." He said, "It is that for our group purpose, there's an ultimate authority called God, and that he makes the decisions, not you. If you're running by what you want to do and she's running by what she wants to do, eventually you'll come into conflict and you will never agree. If you're running according to what your higher power would have you do, you can both make compromises and meet in the middle." And I went in that house that night, and I had a different set of eyes. A couple of days later, I go for dinner with a guy, not even my sponsor, and he says, "Hey, how are you doing?" I said, "Good, you know, let's have a salad." So we're eating a salad, and he says, "You know, I was thinking about you the other day. I bet you're the worst lovemaker in Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Bob, I don't know what your point is, but if I were you, I'd come to it really quick." He said, "There's no point. I just look at you, and you're so selfish and self-contained, and I just think you'd be lousy in bed." I said, "What has this got to do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous?" He said, "This is about practicing your principles in all your affairs. You shouldn't be having affairs, and you're probably a lousy lovemaker." He said, "I'm going to teach you what to do." I said, "I don't think you are." He said, "Yeah, I am." He said, "What I want you to do is I want you to go home, I want you to bath, I want you to get really cleaned up, I want you to shave just like you were going on a date. I want you to put on your cologne, I want you to get into bed, I want you to hold your wife for at least 20 minutes. And don't do anything, just hold her. And I want you, after the 20 minutes is over, to tell her how special it is that you've had somebody like her in your life, that when you were a raging idiot out there drinking, and even now, she is raising your children, she's keeping your home together, she has been a privilege for you to have in your life. You just tell her that, and then shut up. And then I want you to go to sleep." What an order. I can't go through with it. I go home, I shower, the cologne, the blah, 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 get into the bed, hold the woman. Oh, God, this is going on forever. I got prickly fingers already, you know. It's like, and I say to her, "Honey, you know, I'm so proud of what you've done with the kids and everything." And I lay there. She's quiet for a minute, and then she says, "Are you having an affair?" Do you know why? Because she had never heard me ever say anything like that in her life. She thought I was trying to con her another time. She didn't even understand the concept of just holding or loving. That is the abuse I brought into my home. Fast forward here. I got three kids. I've got a son that's 22 years sober. I've got a son that's 20 years sober. Isn't that amazing? I've got a daughter that got just smoked at 16. I mean, just hammered. And I thought, yep, one out of three. I love these kids with all my heart and soul. I was able, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to become part of a family. It's a miracle. I never was part of anything in my life. I love and serve this family. My wife is in my business with me. She's the single best business partner I've ever had in my life. Isn't this story nauseating? And, you know, we've been blessed with money and travel, and God has been so good, and I have been many, many times off the path. And I'm not saying that your marriage can come back together, or maybe you even want it to. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that you know, what happened to me is the norm. But what I am telling you is that if you are willing to do these things on a continuing basis against your own will, against your own better judgment, if you will shift your paradigm, God has for you things that you have no concept. Do not make a list of what you want in your early days. It will be too small. It would be too small. And it's here. It's right now. It's today. It's until midnight tonight. I'm going to finish up just reading a little quick thing here more about alcoholism. It says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can make such a defense. The defense must come from a higher power. God bless all of you, and thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you.